I fought for my children, for my friends, for my family, for my community.
A veteran deported.
They said, no, you don't qualify for citizenship because of your lack of moral character.
We talked to Miguel Perez Montes from Tijuana and another veteran who runs a safe house for people like him. Also, the New York Times finally writes an obituary for a young Korean who died fighting for independence.
It's important to recognize people who you don't know anything about them, but they have also played a part.
And after a controversial appointment at the Brooklyn Museum's African Art Department, we take a closer look at the overwhelming whiteness of art studies.
For many decades, the most influential scholars and curators were people of European and white American origins.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, March 30th, 2018. The Texas Civil Rights Project estimates in total about 3,000 veterans have been deported. That's right. I said 3,000 U.S. veterans have been deported. But that's a number no one wants to focus on. The Department of Homeland Security does not officially keep track of the number of U.S. veterans who have been deported. But we now know for sure that that number has grown by at least one. U.S. Army veteran Miguel Perez Montes, a man who served two tours of duty in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2004, was walked across the U.S.-Mexican border because of a felony drug conviction last Friday. We reached out to Miguel in Tijuana, Mexico, where he met up with another deported U.S. veteran, Hector Barajas. Hector runs the Deported Veterans Support House in Tijuana. Veterans who live there in the support house call it the bunker, and that's where Miguel is now staying. Yes, the predicament is so common that there is now a safe house for U.S. veterans deported in Mexico. Also with us is Emma Hilbert. She's a staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project. But we start with Miguel Perez Montes and his story.
The last month has been just chaos. I was at the detention center in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I was on a 40-day religious fast just so I can, praying to my higher power so I can give me the strength so I can accept the decisions that were coming ahead of me. And people in administration weren't too pleased with that. So I was put in segregation for a while. They cut off my water. They wanted me to knock on the door every time I wanted to get a drink of water. And after I made a couple phone calls and people started calling the detention center and calling ICE, I was transferred down to Kankakee, Illinois, which was a little bit better. And ICE called me for a citizenship interview where we had been talking about maybe doing retroactive citizenship before I committed the felony. But they were aware of the situation, so they called me and they said they were going to look that over. We did the citizenship interview. They did the exam, the test that they do, the citizenship. I passed it with no problems. It was all smiles and everything. I was asked to look at the paper, make sure that my name and everything was spelled correctly, because that was going to be exactly how it's going to appear on the citizenship certificate. You sure it's okay? Yes. Okay. See you at 11. Then it was, we'll see you at noon. And about 2:15 that day, which was the 15th, March 15th, I believe, we got the answer around 2:15, and they said, no, you don't qualify for citizenship because of your lack of moral character.
They told you, no, you do not qualify for citizenship, even though you are a U.S. veteran and you served two tours of duty. When you heard that no, what did you think?
I was devastated because I still believe, I'm never going to change this, the United States Constitution and the laws are the best ones in the world. But just because they are the best doesn't make them perfect, and they got a few flaws. But it's not so much the constitutions and the written law. I believe it's just the people that interpret the law or have the power to bend it a little bit, and they can go either way. And in my case, they decided to go a different way. So I'm devastated with the people that are behind that. But now with the American citizen or with the people, with the constitution, with the law, I don't feel wrong by them. No, because that's the reason I went to war. I wasn't drafted. I signed up, I volunteered. I put on the uniform with the flag that said U.S. Army. It didn't say any other country army, United States Army. And there's something that I'm proud of because I fought for my children, for my friends, for my family, for my community. I understand that when I came back and I wasn't behaving the right way and committed a mistake, a felony, but I paid for that. And I felt was like, now I'm being charged twice. I paid for this, and now I get a receipt saying, well, you still owe.
Miguel, I want to ask you if you could just describe when they escorted you across the border. Did they drive you across? Did you walk across? Can you just can you paint that picture for me?
I was still in the plane when one of the ICE officers runs up to the plane, goes inside, and he's like, Miguel Perez Montes. And I'm right here. I'm all the way in the back, handcuffed by myself with two other officers watching me the whole flight. That I don't understand. But he's like, hey, you're the veteran, right? And I said, yes. He's like, he's coming with me. And then he's like, what happened? He's like, how come you're not a citizen? So we just small talk. He's like, yeah. He's like, well, come on. You're coming with me. He's like, we need to fix this. So he takes the handcuffs off, and he gives me the bag, and we're like, yeah, we need to correct this. And once we go through this door, like a gate, right through there, he's like, go ahead. He closed the door right behind around, and he's like, we're done here. That's it. I said, what? He's like, you see those arrows, those green arrows? That's the Mexican immigration. Go ask them for help. We're done here, and walked away. So I was standing there on the bridge, just staring at the flag, the U.S. side of the border, just brokenhearted. And the first thing that came to my mind, I was like, this is not happening. This is not happening. It's not happening. And I try to look for a way out completely. I can talk about it now because that thought is gone, but not the feeling of what happened. My first reaction was like, I got to jump off this bridge, but it's fenced in, so you can't really jump out. And I was just stuck with the clothes that they gave me from prison from 2016 that have been in property this whole time, which is just a pair of prison joggers and a white T-shirt. And my shoes with no shoelaces.
So, Miguel, I want to bring in Emma, staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project. So, Emma, you study these numbers. How common are cases like Miguel's where you have people who have served in the U.S. military that are being deported?
They're a lot more common than we'd like. The estimates we have are that about 3,000 veterans have been deported today. You know, it's hard to kind of get a very accurate figure because immigration services don't necessarily track whether or not a person they're deporting is a veteran or not. But based on stories, you know, like Miguel's, like Hector's, we estimate that number is pretty astounding.
So you mentioned that these numbers are difficult to come by. Why doesn't the federal government want to count these cases?
That's a really good question. I mean, if you think about just the idea of deporting a veteran who served honorably in the U.S., that's frankly the most un-American thing you can do. The other problem that from a legal perspective is that when a veteran is facing deportation, for certain crimes, the immigration judge has no obligation to even consider whether or not that person is a veteran, to even consider, you know, the number of times they're deployed, their honorable service, their ties to their family and the community in the U.S. or their home. So you really don't even get the tracking on that end as people are being deported.
Hector Barajas, I understand this situation has gotten so bad that you are trying to help all of the U.S. veterans who have been deported by creating a safe house of sorts in Mexico.
Yes, we have a deported veteran support house here in Tijuana. Recently opened up another one in Juarez a year ago. We're actually on our one-year anniversary for that one. And we're gearing up. We're already planning a trip to Dominican Republic and Jamaica.
So what are some of the unique needs and risks that U.S. veterans who have been deported face?
Sure. One of the immediate needs are the housing, having a safe place to go and basically having that stability and even just being able to speak that language, English language. And the other one is getting them their IDs, birth certificates, job placement, some of the things that they face is, you know, they could be deported to a country where there's a lot of instability. So it's just, you know, there's that uncertainty of what's next, you know. So it can be a very difficult situation, and you're putting that person on a traumatic experience is just being deported.
In your situation, you were also deported. You served in the U.S. military, is that right?
Yes, I served from 1995 to 2001. I was an 82nd Airborne Paratrooper, honorably discharged, and I was deported in 2004, snuck back to the country, got caught again, and I finally decided to stay here and start my advocacy a couple of years after, and it's led to the resource centers that we have, and we believe in the motto of leaving no man behind.
So many of these men were defending the U.S. and then were kicked out of the country. How do you help them make sense of that situation?
One of the most important things is not giving up. You know, I'm not, you know, I didn't give up 14 years ago, but accepting the reality, hey, I'm in Mexico, I got to be a productive citizen, I got to get my IDs, I got to do all these different things. And that helps. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is get these guys, hey, you know, get a job, do this, do that, while you're waiting, you know, and get your VA benefits. You know, there's different things that we need to work on to make sure that they're, you know, that there's some stability. And I think accepting the reality of where you're at, not giving up, is very important.
And you can actually get VA benefits while you're in Mexico, so you can see a doctor or just get payments?
You can get your payments, and then there's a program called the Foreign Medical Program, and you can see doctors for your service-related disabilities, only for service-related disabilities, and the VA will reimburse you for those doctors and medications, but you have to be service-connected.
Now, for a lot of people listening right now, so many hearts are going out to you right now, but there is, in some cases, a silver lining, and I understand that you may actually be coming back to the USA now?
Yes, I have I have a ceremony to complete the citizenship process on April 13th, Friday at 10 a.m., so looks like my ordeal has finally ended, but not my mission. You know, I decided to stay here for one more year in Tijuana, you know, being able to go back and forth. And eventually I want to have a job and where I can get paid to provide stability for my family that I haven't been able to take care of. But I'll still continue working on this. And I think I can do a lot more from over there than here, but continue to make sure that we take care of our men and women.
So what was the secret? What was the solution for you?
So the biggest hurdle for any deported veteran is the crime. You have to get rid of the crime. And there's various options. Every case is different. Every case has its merits. But in my particular case, I got a full unconditional pardon from the governor of California. So that got rid of the crime. And that's, you know, basically I'm eligible for citizenship. So I'm going home finally.
Well, thank you for your service and welcome back to the USA. Now, Miguel, what about you? What are your next steps?
My immediate next step, it's just cloudy because of the culture shock and the recent events. But I also have to continue fighting and giving it all I can for all the deported veterans and those in detention. But it's like today or tomorrow, I have my mother visiting me from the United States, so I'm just spending a couple of days and just not to think about anything. I haven't been able to hug my mother for 9 years, so this was great to be out and to spend some time with her.
Miguel Perez Montes, a veteran who's recently been deported, Emma Hilbert, staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Hector Barajas, veteran and founder of the Deported Veterans Support House. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway. You're back with me, Duarte Geraldino, on The Takeaway today. This week, our show is hosting two journalists through a global exchange program. They're from the African countries of Lesotho and Zambia. They've been a part of our editorial process, and in our discussions about the Me Too movement, they've told us it's not quite resonating the same way in their countries as it is here in the USA. But change is happening for women, and some of those changes are starting in the workplace. Take this story. In 2014, three women soldiers in the Lesotho Defense Forces were fired after telling their supervisors that they were pregnant. But these women soldiers fought back. They took the Lesotho military to court. It was only last month that the case was resolved. A judge ruled in the women's favor. They were reinstated on March 1st. Keso Moklabudi is the co-founder of the MNN Center for Investigative Journalism in Lesotho. She's been covering this story.
The Lesotho Defense Force has 3,100 soldiers in total. And even though the public affairs officer always refused to tell us the exact number of women within the LDF, the estimated calculations are that there are approximately 12% representation.
So just 12% representation. With these women in particular, what happened to them?
In 2014, the former army commander for Lesotho Defense Force introduced a standing order barring female soldiers from being pregnant for the first 5 years of service. He said there was no room for childbearing because of the heavy weapons that they would be using for the first 5 years. And it was the first time the army introduced such an order.
These women didn't take too well to this.
According to what they told the court when they sued the army, is that we just took the order and continued to join the service. But we have the customary law that allows women to fall pregnant and bear children. So when they found out that they were pregnant, they immediately reported to their supervisors that they were pregnant. And unfortunately, they were fired from the army. That is when they took the matter to their lawyers to sue the army.
The irony is these are women who are trained to fight because they are soldiers and they fought for their rights to bear children. Were you surprised by the way the court case turned out?
So the details in the affidavits where they tried to reason and show how the military was discriminating them at workplace, I was not quite surprised about the judgment.
And in terms of women's rights in the country, are other women in other industries also standing up for themselves because of the victory in this particular case?
Most women were happy because after several publications of the victory of these three women who were reinstated, there are soldiers who came up and declared that they had to hide their pregnancies and go through abortion without the military knowing that they are pregnant and they terminated their pregnancies. So the judgment was quite fulfilling because it then now says if it was illegal and invalid for the military to set up or introduce such a standing order during this time of reforms, then it's highly likely that it's going to be cancelled. Women will be free to fall pregnant and bear children as per the constitution and our customary law.
Thank you so much, Keso Moklabudi, the co-founder of MNN Center for Investigative Journalism in Lesotho.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking about how women in the Lesotho military challenge the system to secure their rights in the workforce, but they're not the norm. Women across Africa still face deeply rooted expectations that they should just stay home. And in the workplace, they're seriously disadvantaged compared to men. My next guest says a lot of that boils down to social capital. Dr. Mojubaolu Okome is here to talk with us about the challenges African women are facing. She's professor of political science, African and women's studies at Brooklyn College. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Okome, you know, progress has been made in a lot of fronts for women in the workplace across Africa, but can you talk about some of the most significant signals of progress versus some of the current challenges?
I think we have to make a separation between women who are in the formal workforce and women in the informal economy. Majority of African women work in the informal economy. If one is looking at informal economy, you'll actually find that across the board, there's a high rate of female labor force participation, with the exception of the Northern African region, you know. So when one looks at this, over 60% of African women are involved in the labor force. But because of the dominance of the informal economy, most of these jobs show elements of underemployment, also lack of decent work conditions, which the ILO describes as a situation where people don't have social protections like pensions and a short enough work day. You know, you might have to work round the clock to make the same amount of money that somebody who works maybe a 9-to-5 is making. This is a significant issue because this is something that majority of African women experience.
In the United States, there's that saying, it's not often what you know, but who you know that helps your career advance. Is that the same thing at play in Africa? And are women at a disadvantage based on who they know, who they have access to?
Yes. You know, there's that element. There is also an element of very strong bias against women. So sexism plays a role, and then access to social capital and the advantages that it brings plays a role. So we have to make a distinction based on class, but then there's also bias towards women, so that if a woman is as qualified as a man and they're seeking employment, the preference is given to men because of a lot of beliefs about women's performance, that women's performance might be affected by motherhood. And then there's a lot of, there's sometimes social barriers to having women take positions of leadership. So women would tend to be given opportunities where there's a lot of service and less pay.
If you could touch very, very briefly on the Me Too movement, it's taken up so much attention here in the U.S. and in parts of Europe, but in Africa, is there as much of an emphasis on the Me Too movement?
If we are looking for the words Me Too, there are a few Africans on social media that have talked about Me Too. So people are talking, they're talking more, but until there are legal protections where laws are enforced that punish people who perpetrate these acts of violence towards women, and then there's social support for victims, you are not going to have a huge movement of people talking about their personal trauma and pain in public when there's no recourse, really.
Mojubaolu Okeme, Professor of Political Science, African and Women's Studies at Brooklyn College. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's sort of like the Virginia Woolf quote, anonymous was a woman.
Her name was Alice Foley.
Emily Warren Roebling.
Nella Larson.
Yu Guansun.
Mary Outerbridge.
The New York Times has been writing new obituaries for great women whose deaths were never really widely acknowledged.
I think of her as someone who constantly questioned, to what extent should other people's expectations determine who we are?
She was definitely a pioneer of the sport in the U.S.
Her care model and her initiative and activism in this greatly predates a lot of AIDS awareness and activism in this country.
She didn't really get credit for the work that she did, and she certainly didn't receive an obit.
I'm honored to be able to tell her story.
It's called The Overlooked Project, and we've been bringing you some of the stories about those women over the past few weeks. To hear them, along with your nominations, log on to our website at thetakeaway.org/overlooked. Well, today, a story about the power of a young person, a teenager, who rose up and pushed for change. Sound familiar? Well, we're not talking about 2018. No, we're going back almost 100 years to a teen hero from 1919, Yu Guansun. She was a young fighter for Korean independence.
So Yu Guansun was a teenage girl who was growing up in occupied Korea at the beginning of the 20th century. She was born in 1902, and Korea was annexed by Japan a few years later. So she would have been too young to remember a free Korea. And she died decades before the country was liberated in 1945 at the end of World War II.
That's In Young Kang there, editor at the news desk at the New York Times and author of the new obituary for Yu Guansun. And Kang says, while Yoo Gwan-soon may have been overlooked by the times, she's a beloved symbol in South Korea.
She is a public figure, I would say, maybe along the lines of Susan B. Anthony, someone who fought for her rights, her country.
I asked about Yoo Gwan-soon's short life and lasting legacy.
She was a high school student, and she took part in these independence marches in Seoul. And for this, she was arrested, imprisoned, and tortured, and she ended up dying in prison.
What about her accomplishments? What exactly did she do?
She was best known for being part of the March 1st Independence Movement, which is a national holiday in Korea. And this was the first large-scale protest against Japanese colonial rule. So she took part in the main protest in Seoul, which is the capital. And then later she went to her home province in South Chungcheong. And she went from village to village on foot, spreading word of what had happened and encouraging villagers to take part in their own protests.
And she paid a huge price for that. What happened once she was in her home village encouraging all these villagers to take part in this protest?
So she organized a rally in her hometown, and about 3,000 people showed up on April 1st, 1919, chanting, calling for independence. And the Japanese authorities showed up, and they fired on the crowd, killing 19 people, including her parents.
Her parents died too. And then from that moment, she was immediately arrested?
She was arrested then, yes.
How long did she live after she was arrested? How much time transpired?
Not much longer than a year. So she died September 28th, 1920.
And when she died, I read the obituary that you wrote. She writes something. She scribbles something on the wall. What does she write?
She wrote, "Even if my fingernails are torn out, my nose and ears are ripped apart, and my legs and arms are crushed, this physical pain does not compare to the pain of losing my nation." She also wrote, "Japan will fall." And it turned out to be true 20 years later, but she didn't live to see it.
Can you talk about how she's inspired people?
I guess what's interesting to me about this century in Korean history is so much happened in such a short period of time. You know, it was occupied by Japan, the World War happened, the Korean War happened. And then for almost three decades after that, the country was under a series of military dictatorships. And so I think there's always been that undercurrent of you fight for what you believe to be right, for democracy, for freedom. I think it is just one example of someone who believed in something so strongly that she was willing to fight for it, to die for it, to spread word of it. That's kind of, it's not specific to a country or a time period. It's kind of a universal feeling.
And how did you hear about her? How did she take up such an important role in your mind that you go and visit the museum dedicated to her in South Korea?
You know, I can't pinpoint exactly when I first heard about her. I think growing up, my parents, who were both born in Korea, they learned about her in school, and she's pretty well known, I think, there. And so I'd heard the name at some point, but I remember, I think I might have been in middle school or something. We were visiting family in Seoul. This was end of February, early March, and I saw these Korean flags out, you know, on the street. And I was like, oh, you know, what's that for? And my mom goes, oh, that's for the March 1st holiday, which is the movement that she's known for. In Korean, it's Hamil, which means 3-1 or March 1st. That was the date of the main march in Seoul in 1919. It was the first major demonstration against Japanese colonial rule.
We know that she left some writing,
And
we know that she fought. Do we know anything else about her relatives?
So her father, she was born to Christian parents, and so I think her father taught her a lot about Christianity. And also there's a strong sort of Confucian tradition in which they value nationalism, patriotism, knowing about one's people, and civic awareness in general. And so she learned a lot from her family. She was influenced by her family. But over the course of three generations, 9 people in total from the Yoo family were involved in the independence movement.
So this was in her blood. And now, why should the world recognize this young woman? Why is it so important that her life, her story, her passion, and her death be remembered?
So I went to grad school for French history, actually, and there was this concept that I came across when I was reading. It's called Alltagsgeschichte, which is a German theory of historiography. It looks at the experiences of ordinary people who can often become extraordinary. Alltag means everyday life, and so the idea is by looking at everyday experiences of, you know, your average normal person in society, it can help our understanding of larger sociopolitical issues. So it's a form of microhistory, and I'm honored to be able to tell her story. And honestly, I think part of the difficulty in writing this piece was that there is so little English language material out there on her. And so when I went to the museum, you know, they were speaking to me in Korean. All their materials were in Korean, and I'm not fluent, and so I had a translator help me with that. But I think in general, it's an accessibility issue. So I hope there's more writing about her.
In-young Kang is an editor on the news desk at the New York Times. Find her new obituary for Korean independence activist Yoo Gwan-soon at nytimes.com/overlooked. The Brooklyn Museum is taking a lot of heat on social media because it just appointed a white woman as curator of African art. Her name is Kristen Winmuller Luna. With so much recent attention on underrepresentation of marginalized communities, this appointment struck many as particularly tone-deaf. Here to provide some insight into this ongoing discussion is Chika Okeke-Agulu. Not only is he professor of African art at Princeton's Department of Art and Archaeology, as well as African American Studies, but he was also Kristen Winmuller Luna's mentor. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Professor Okeke-Agulu, you're in a unique position here. You've written about the need to diversify the institutional art world, and you were also the new art director's advisor at Princeton. What are your thoughts on this controversy?
Well, there are two things. First of all, I think that the museum made the right call in hiring Kristen for this position because she's extremely highly qualified for it. So I'm not surprised that she got the job. But then there's the larger question of misrepresentation or lack of diversity of African and African diaspora peoples and cultures in art and cultural institutions in the United States and elsewhere. So these are two different things, and it's important to insist on the second part about lack of diversity, but it's also important not to then sound as if we're arguing that non-Black and white curators or scholars cannot and should not be hired to teach and curate African art.
Because the reverse is also troubling. So the notion that a person of color or a Black person couldn't be an expert on, say, French art.
Precisely. And in fact, the history of African art as a discipline makes it obvious why it's dangerous to now sound as if we're arguing that only Black people should be responsible for curating and teaching African art. And my point is that the very origins of African art as a discipline and as a section of museums and museum collections can be found in Europe during the Age of Empire. And for many decades, the most influential scholars and curators were people of European and white American origins. And it took many decades for a new generation of scholars and curators who were Black or especially from the African continent to begin to argue and to press for greater diversity within the discipline. Now, there is some progress that has been made. And so we must insist on increasing and continuing that trend in diversification of the field. But I think it is dangerous for us to turn around and seem to suggest that we either expel white scholars and curators working within the discipline or not to hire any white person.
So the critics will say that it's just so troubling because there are many scholars of color who are experts in African art, and yet they're not getting some of these high-profile positions. Specifically, you know, they point to a 2015 statistic from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation that only 4% of museum curators in North America are Black. So when we think that only 4% of museum curators in North America are Black, and then you have this appointment, some people say, wait a minute, come on.
I can understand that. But if you also look at the Brooklyn Museum, you will find that about 17 curators that they have seven or so are people of color. And this is really my point, that some institutions have done more in diversifying their curatorial and top management staff. Some have done far less. So it's important to keep looking at the bigger picture about underrepresentation of people of color in the art world, not just museums, including art schools, the professorial cadre. But that doesn't then mean that every job that is available on the scene must be given to people of color. In the case of the Brooklyn Museum, I would, for instance, be interested in knowing who applied for the job and who was given due diligence in terms of the search process. Those are the kinds of things that I am interested in, rather than mapping the big picture problem that I've been describing onto every single job hire.
So the roots are much, much deeper. Now, you have written a lot about the gentrification of modern African art. Do you believe that this particular example is something that is going to become, or is in fact, the norm across America?
I'm not sure if the question that we have today, which is about the hire of Kristen, a white woman, as the African curator in Brooklyn, is directly connected, in my opinion, to the broader question of gentrification that I've spoken about. Because the way I understand that problem has to do with the museum itself as an institution that belongs in a community of Brooklyn in New York. Now, the problem that I see there is the matter of audiences. Who are the audiences of these museums like Brooklyn? Because the stronger and the more vocal the audience, the more likely that the museum will listen to its issues and so forth. So gentrification in places like Brooklyn will more likely push out poor Black folks who lived in that area. The problem, though, is that if that neighborhood is gentrified, then it's most likely going to be speaking to the same wealthy white folks who then earn more money, become directors, become trustees of the museum, and therefore the cycle just closes itself.
Chika Okeke Agulu, professor of African art at Princeton's Department of Art and Archaeology and African American Studies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will.
Next week marks 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We'll be spending several days looking at his legacy. On Monday, we speak with Nelson Mauldin and Kevin Sherrod, authors of The Colored Waiting Room, Empowering the Original and the New Civil Rights Movements. Here's Kevin Sherrod sharing his thoughts about how, over time, civil rights history in the U.S. has been sanitized.
There are a lot of lessons that can be learned from that history. Unfortunately, it's just not being taught in schools today, right? We get the watered-down version. We get the I Have a Dream speech, and we get Rosa Parks on the bus, right? We don't get the intricate details. You know, 13 months of boycotting the buses in Montgomery, it forced them to change the policy.
So students and teachers, we want to hear from you. How is the life and legacy of Dr. King taught in schools today? Are young Americans getting the full picture? Call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Until then, enjoy the Easter and Passover weekend. I'm Duarte Geraldino. You can tweet me at Duarte Geraldino. I'll be back next week, filling in until Todd Tulik returns on Thursday. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.